And these legalistic strategies, what Juan called lawfare, all the way back into the Trump presidency, have really been ways of trying to put things back the way they were, rather than recognizing that a lot of American people are willing to bracket Trump's evil and vote for him anyway, because the Democrats are not appealing. And that's the challenge I think we all need to face, rather than side with centrist Democrats and never Trump Republicans who just want to get rid of Trump as if nothing happened.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Samuel Moyn, professor of law and history at Yale University. We'll link to your New York Times op-ed. The Supreme Court should overturn the Colorado ruling unanimously. And Praveen Fernandez, vice president of Constitutional Accountability Center, which filed an amicus brief in the Colorado lawsuit. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Tarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
In this country, almost 99% of the meat and dairy we eat comes from industrialized factory farms. By and large, they are terrible places for animals, and some states have passed laws to make those farms a little bit more humane. But now, lawmakers in Congress want to pass the EATS Act, which would effectively negate those laws. On the next Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Wayne Pacelli, president of Animal Wellness Action and Center for a Humane Economy, about the EATS Act, what it means for animals, and for the safety of our food supply.
We can use our human creativity and our incredible capacity for innovation to deliver food to people that doesn't leave animals in such a terrible state of distress.
You don't have to be vegan or vegetarian to care about animal welfare. Don't miss the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, January 26th at 10 a.m. here on 90.7 KBOO FM.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday night,
midnight
to 3 a.m. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound.
Sounds unsound.
Only on KBOO.
Sounds unsound.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland voters will decide on renewing a 10 cents a gallon gas tax on the ballot in May.
A new report shows how often Portland police evade accountability for use of force.
And in national news, Alabama plans to execute a prisoner with a troubling experimental method.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 24th, 2024. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Portlanders will be seeing a 10-cent gas tax renewal on their primary ballot this May. City councilors voted to send the renewal to the voters today. The gas tax program is called Fixing Our Streets, and it was first implemented in 2016. In the last 8 years, it has generated $150 million for the Portland Bureau of Transportation, also known as PBOT. That helped fund repaving projects, new signal and beacon installation, sidewalk construction, and the Safe Routes to School program. The City Transportation Bureau is facing a $32 million shortfall in their budget, and PBOT expects the gas tax will bring in $75 million in the next 4 years. A funding lifeline from the Portland Clean Energy Fund seems to be on the way as well, but that budget situation for the Transportation Bureau is still pretty grim. Last spring, City Council voted to reduce a 40-cent increase in parking fees downtown to 20 cents, citing a decline in activity downtown. The gas tax renewal is supported by community transportation advocates and members of PBOT's advisory committee. Sarah Iaroni is the executive director of the Street Trust. She said in a press release, quote, "In the face of Portland's worst traffic fatality numbers in four decades, and given the disproportionate risks to pedestrians and the unhoused, especially in East Portland, the city's shortfall in transportation funding isn't just a budget issue. It's an urgent public safety emergency calling for immediate action. It's important that voters support this stopgap effort, even as we all work to find more sustainable long-term solutions for funding safe streets in our city."
As of yesterday, there were 645 people in Multnomah County with outstanding criminal charges and no attorney, the most ever, according to data compiled by the Oregon Judicial Department. That's a problem, because people facing criminal charges in the U.S. are entitled to a public defender if they can't afford a lawyer on their own. Policymakers have tried to address the public defender shortage by providing millions of dollars, with probably millions more to come, in bonuses to lawyers willing to take on those cases. It remains a conundrum. Why does it seem like there are enough attorneys to handle the cases? Multnomah County hired six new public defenders in the second half of 2023. Until very recently, Oregon didn't employ its own public defenders, but contracted the work out. Those contracts include caseload maximums, but it's left up to lawyers and their firms to decide how many clients they can manage at once. Because of this, it's very difficult to determine what constitutes a full workload and whether resources are being used at full capacity. Carl McPherson is the head of Metropolitan Public Defenders, the largest contractor in Multnomah County. He says the Oregon Judicial Department's data is misleading, and that maximum attorney caseload, quote, "is an arbitrary and inaccurate measurement of attorney capacity," end quote. A new office of state-employed attorneys began taking cases in December and plans to hire more new attorneys.
A new report finds that Portland police use force at higher than average rates. The report also says these officers are not being held accountable for their actions. Eric Tegedoff has more.
A new report says the Portland Police Bureau is obscuring information on officers who use excessive force on the job. Researchers with the organization Control Alt Defund investigated use of force data between 2017 and 2023 through public records requests and found only a few officers account for many of these incidences. The highest rate was from Officer Damian Dale, who used force 23 times in 2023. The average for officers that year was 2.7. Sarah Hamid is with Freedom to Thrive, which supported the research.
What this report was able to validate was that not only is this violence happening, but this violence is happening in a concentrated way from certain officers who are known to police leadership.
Under an Oregon law passed in 2021, Portland police are required to provide the name of officers upon request. The Bureau keeps a use of force dashboard, but officers are identified with a randomly generated number rather than their badge number. In an email responding to the report, Sergeant Kevin Allen said the use of force occurs in a small number of cases, less than 0.5% of all calls, and that disparities occur because some officers work in busier areas than others. Hamid says despite the dashboard the Portland Police Bureau provides, a lot of work was required to identify officers who use force excessively.
This should be something that's publicly accessible and constantly accessible, because this is the kind of transparency that allows individuals who have been victimized by these officers to seek retribution and justice.
Hamid says rather than investing in training for officers who use force, the city should listen to the people who have been victimized by these officers.
Do what those communities have been asking for, which is start funding public resources and services so that people's living conditions can improve. That needs to be where all of the money from the city's coffers is going right now, not towards more violent policing.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Alabama is preparing to carry out the nation's first nitrogen gas execution. Scheduled for this Thursday, but experts have raised medical concerns about the potential risks of this untested method. Kenneth Eugene Smith's case continues to spark legal and ethical debates as his lawyers appeal to stop the execution. Shantia Hudson has more in the story.
Alabama prison officials are preparing to execute a prisoner this Thursday by putting a mask on his face and using nitrogen gas, a method that has never been attempted in an American prison. The planned execution of Kenneth Eugene Smith is raising significant concerns among medical experts about the potential dangers associated with this approach. Maurice Shama with the Marshall Project spoke with experts at the American College of Correctional Physicians who say the method is experimental.
The Constitution bars cruel and unusual punishment, And lawyers for Kenneth Eugene Smith have argued that some of the risks of this execution could look like cruel and unusual punishment. He could vomit, asphyxiate, go into a seizure, go into a coma or a vegetative state.
Sharma adds doctors have pointed out the nitrogen could leak into the room, perhaps affecting correctional officers or spiritual advisors. While Alabama would be the first state to carry out a nitrogen execution, other states have included nitrogen as a possible method. Oklahoma is reportedly developing its own execution method using nitrogen. Smith was convicted of killing Elizabeth Sennett in 1988 after being hired by her husband seeking a life insurance payout. Sharma says Alabama attempted to execute Smith in 2008. And 22 by lethal injection, but gave up after spending hours trying to insert an IV. Sharma's research indicates that some execution standards have been influenced by veterinarian practices, but many vets avoid using nitrogen on mammals because it can cause distress. He notes experts have argued that improper mask fitting could lead to the same result.
And in that scenario, there's a lack of clarity over what they would do. Would they continue on and try to carry through the execution and kill him, frankly? Or would he now be in a coma that, you know, the prison system and the state and taxpayers are having to manage?
Sharma says Smith's lawyers are working to halt the execution, appealing to higher federal courts, including the 11th Circuit. He adds a Supreme Court decision could ultimately shape Smith's fate. For Alabama News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
Over 400 workers at Vogue, GQ, Vanity Fair, and other Condé Nast media brands walked off the job Tuesday to protest unlawful bargaining practices. Condé Nast CEO Roger Lynch announced plans last November to lay off roughly 5% of its staff, representing about 300 people. Since then, the News Guild of New York has filed multiple unfair labor practice charges with the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB. News Guild represents Condé Nast media workers, and they allege that the media conglomerate violated labor laws by offering severance proposals that were half the initial offered payouts. The labor group also alleges Condé Nast engaged in surveillance and intimidation tactics on multiple occasions when union members asked about the nature of their layoffs. On Monday, the union stated, quote, "Any changes to working conditions, including layoffs, must be negotiated," end quote. Union members began a 24-hour strike yesterday, timed to coincide with the announcement of the 96th Academy Awards. Keeping in theme with the day's events, striking workers staged an Oscars-themed picket line at Condé Nast's One World Trade Center offices. Ben Dewey is the union's Condé Nast unit vice chair, and in response to the decision to hold the strike on Tuesday, Dewey said, quote, "We just really want to show how much Condé relies on union members to cover big events like the Oscar nominations," end quote. The Condé Nast strike follows the decision by unionized staffers at the LA Times on a one-day strike to protest sweeping job cuts there.
New Hampshire voters go to the polls in their state's primary. Some states are considering universal voting, and a bipartisan border deal may be getting closer to fruition. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Luck and being born in the right zip code in the United States of America should not be the determinant of where you end up in the United States of America. People who are fortunate, like I have been, have a responsibility to stand up and serve.
Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips on his long-shot bid to take the Democratic nomination from President Joe Biden. In spite of not being on the ballot, the president has won the New Hampshire primary thanks to a successful write-in campaign. With less than a quarter of the votes counted, media outlets also declared former President Donald Trump the winner over former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley by a sound but not huge margin. Trump looks likely to get more than 52% of the votes in a high turnout election, a result sure to increase calls for Haley to drop out. North Dakota Governor and former candidate Doug Burgum is now stumping for Trump, preparing for a race against the incumbent.
When Donald Trump was president, our nation was safe and our nation was prosperous. Joe Biden, his weakness has led to war. His weakness and his appeasement has led to our adversaries like Iran and Russia making hundreds of billions of dollars selling oil to China.
Observers say China isn't actually buying oil from Iran now. The most recent economic data shows a very low unemployment rate and slowing inflation, along with improving economic confidence. The U.S. ranked 31st for global voter turnout, but some states are considering requiring citizens to go to the polls. Many high turnout countries like Australia have what's known as universal voting, and Miles Rappaport with 100% Democracy says it could change the incentives and make politics more moderate.
Right now, the currency in the United States for campaigns and political parties is to gin up your own base as much as you can. Some people say it's enraged to engage, and then try to depress the turnout of your opponents.
Senate leadership is sounding a bit more confident about a bipartisan deal on border funding and foreign aid. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says divided government has succeeded in forcing what could be a successful compromise.
If this were not divided government, we wouldn't have an opportunity to do anything about the border. In fact, I don't think we'd get 60 votes for any border plan if we had a fully Republican government.
Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says hard-right Republicans have only made a difficult conversation harder because they want an issue, not a solution.
Many of them are motivated by naked partisanship. Others are taking cues from Donald Trump. These hard-right saboteurs talk on and on about the need to fix the border. But now, they don't actually want to see a bipartisan solution on the border.
Massachusetts State Ballot Law Commission has rejected an effort to disqualify the former president from that state's ballot. Tom Hodgson is the chair of the Trump campaign in Massachusetts.
This whole issue is really based on no substantiation that the president was involved in any kind of insurrection. There is no conviction that he's done anything wrong in regards to that.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. Ralph Blomers of Green Oregon breaks down how taxing big timber can support fire-safe communities and how that ties into Oregon's short legislative session. At 6, it's The Underground, produced by KBOO's own Youth Collective. Then at 7, Progressive PDX Talk Radio. Well, our weather forecast after that hailstorm we had this afternoon, it looks like we've got clouds and an ever-present chance of showers with a low of 43 tonight. Tomorrow, rainy and a high of 51. Today in history, in 1990, Japan launched Haiten, the country's first lunar probe. It was the first robotic lunar probe since the Soviet Union's Luna 24 in 1976, and the first lunar probe launched by a country other than Soviet Union or the United States. The quote of the day is from American writer and first female winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction, Edith Wharton, who you might know as the author of The Age of Innocence. She was born this day in 1862, and she wrote, quote, "There are two ways of spreading light, to be the candle or the mirror that reflects it."
Tribes in South Dakota could see a big boon to its affordable housing infrastructure thanks to a bill correction making its way through the legislature. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An oversight correction relating to housing grant dollars in South Dakota tribal settings is advancing through the legislature. Last year, lawmakers passed the $200 million Housing Infrastructure Finance Program, but that program included language excluding tribal governments. House Bill 1041 modifies the bill's definition of public infrastructure to allow federally recognized tribes to claim from that pot. Further, it declares an emergency to allow tribal groups to claim that money sooner than later. The bill was brought by Sioux Falls Republican Representative Tyler Tortson, who sits at Wahpeton. He explains the scope of the proposal.
Housing is a challenge, whether you're in Sioux Falls, whether you're in rural South Dakota, or whether you're in the tribal communities. That was the reason why there was so much support for this. Just make sure that tribes are eligible, tribal entities are eligible, tribal housing authorities and nonprofits that, you know, operate in that area of our state.
Questions were raised about the necessity of an emergency provision in the bill. Sioux Falls Democratic Senator Reynold Nessaba says the need justifies the clause.
My concern is that the grant funding is already gone because that became available July 1st. And so I do think it is urgent. I don't think it was anyone's intention to keep tribal entities from being able to qualify. They have some of the most pressing housing problems in our state.
The bill advanced with a do pass recommendation on an 8-1 vote and will next be heard on the House floor. The U.S. EPA recently announced it reached a settlement with the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. That means the NTUA has agreed to improve wastewater treatment facilities in three communities in northern Arizona. Chris Clements of KSJD has more.
The Department of Justice filed a complaint on behalf of the EPA that says the facilities violated Clean Water Act permits meant to protect human health and the environment by discharging wastewater not treated to proper levels into washes across the tribal nation. It also says the NTUA failed to maintain their facilities' sewage systems and prevent sewage spills. The roughly $100 million settlement will mean some short-term and long-term upgrades to facilities in Chinle, Kayenta, and Tuba City that serve about 20,000 people, mostly Navajo citizens. Beth Abishan is a supervisory natural resource specialist for Region 9 of the EPA.
When we look at Navajo and the type of land it is, water resources are a limited quantity out there. It's important to protect all of them.
Abishan says that NTUA, a nonprofit enterprise of the Navajo Nation, has already begun much of the work needed at its treatment facilities. Federal grants from initiatives like the Bipartisan Infrastructure Plan and other sources are expected to cover the majority of the cost expected for the NTUA under the settlement. I'm Chris Clements.
California state lawmakers and tribal leaders are taking a look at the Feather Alert a year after its implementation. The alert system is used to notify the public and law enforcement about missing Native American people, especially women and girls. It operates similar to the Silver and Amber Alerts. Like other alerts, it's overseen by the California Highway Patrol, although city police and sheriff's departments make the notification request. Assemblymember James Ramos authored the bill, which created the alert system. Ramos will lead a press conference at the state capitol in Sacramento Wednesday, followed by a legislative hearing. Tribal leaders, advocates, and law enforcement officers are expected to take part in both the news conference and hearing. State officials are also listed on the hearing. Ramos, who's the first and only California Native American in the state legislature, was recently named chair of the Assembly Budget Subcommittee, which deals with public safety issues. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Oregon House Democrats have introduced a drug recriminalization bill that would cancel part of the controversial Measure 110. House Bill 4002 would make possession of small amounts of drugs like fentanyl, heroin, and meth a Class C misdemeanor. Police would be required to offer to connect a person with a service provider rather than arresting them and pursuing charges. People caught with small amounts of drugs could avoid a criminal conviction or charges by meeting with a drug treatment provider. The bill would also give law enforcement more power to prosecute dealers by allowing a person caught with a larger amount of drugs to be prosecuted for intent to sell. Under current laws, a dealer must be caught in the act of selling to be arrested for that. Also, the bill would make it easier to get medications to treat opioid addiction and would provide $30 million for additional rehabilitation services. Republicans are offering an alternative bill that has some similarities to HB 4002, but includes stronger penalties for possession and requires that a person seek treatment to avoid criminal penalties. Proponents of Measure 110 came out against the committee's punitive framework. They note a decision to recriminalize drug possession will only exacerbate drug addiction and homelessness and further overwhelm Oregon courts that are already short on public defenders. The short legislative session starts on February 5th.
The Pacific Northwest cold snap last week brought snowpack numbers in the Cascades up in a big way. Before the snow and ice storm, conditions in the mountains pointed towards potential drought. Now, the snow water equivalent in the Oregon Cascades is at 120%, according to the National Water and Climate Center. That's a measure of how much water the snowpack contains, and it helps officials plan for how much water to use throughout the year. It also influences what kind of fire season Oregon might see in the second half of the year. More snowpack and precipitation means more water for Northwest forests for more of the year. When there isn't enough snowpack, forests dry out earlier, making potent tinder for potential wildfires. This is also an El Niño year, which usually means warmer temperatures and less rain and snow in the Northwest. It's possible that a snow deficit could happen again because of that weather pattern, but the burst of Arctic air helped to increase snowpack in the Cascades.
Reining in the oil and gas industry is a key concern for environmental activists worried about our climate future. A New Mexico lawmaker has introduced three bills to reduce pollution by the oil and gas industry. They include restrictions on setbacks, increases fines for chemical spills, and requiring higher royalty payments. Roz Brown spoke with State Representative Debbie Serignana to learn more about her strategy.
A trio of bills to curb oil and gas pollution is under consideration by New Mexico lawmakers. New Mexico is the country's second largest oil producer and a top gas producer. State Representative Debbie Serignana believes policy changes are needed to protect children from pollution and prevent fresh water from being wasted during the state's ongoing mega drought. Despite what some believe, she says the bills are not designed to shut down the industry, which she acknowledges is important to the state's bottom line.
We're just trying to regulate the industry so they're not operating in a way that wastes our fresh water. They have to operate according to basic environmental and public health principles.
The bills would limit the use of fresh water in oil and gas operations, impose mandatory fines for chemical spills, and establish stricter setbacks from school facilities as a means to create child health protection zones. A spokesman for the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association says it's watching the bills and supports those grounded in science. As a member of the Elected Officials to Protect America Coalition, Serignana says she's determined to change how New Mexico gets energy from fossil fuels and transition the state to clean renewables. She feels strongly that adults and children who live near oil and gas wells should not be inhaling byproducts and getting sick.
What makes these people who live in that area so not important that we as a state believe gas and oil should be doing what they want? And these people are getting sicker than their frontline people and their indigenous people and their people of color. And they're just as important as everyone else.
Recent studies have shown that living near oil and gas wells increases a person's exposure to air pollution and thereby increases the likelihood of illness. New Mexico has several towns in the middle of oil fields, as well as schools next to fossil fuel well sites. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
A program that awards grants to projects aiming to make communities more livable for people of all ages is open for applications. The AARP Community Challenge Grant Program began in 2017 and has funded 28 projects in Oregon since. Eric Tagedoff has the details.
A program that funds ideas for improving communities is now open to applications. The AARP Community Challenge Grant Program is accepting applications until March 6th for projects that can be enacted quickly to make cities more livable for people of all ages. Stacy Larson with AARP Oregon says the program has a track record for supporting communities of all sizes.
They deliver really unique support to rural communities. Since the beginning of the program in 2017, 46% of the grants distributed in Oregon have been to rural communities.
Since its start in 2017, the program has invested $16.4 million in more than 1,300 projects nationwide, including 28 in Oregon. The program is open to local nonprofits and governments. A webinar for interested applicants will be held on the AARP website on January 31st at 11 a.m. Applicants can apply in three different grant areas. Those include capacity-building microgrants, demonstration grants, and flagship grants, which allow for the most creativity and flexibility. Larson has some tips for those applying.
The applicants who can demonstrate that they are addressing a clear need that brings positive change to make their communities more livable for residents of all ages, and that they're addressing disparities for people of color or other historically marginalized groups, will find themselves rising to the top.
Selected projects must be completed by December 15th. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
It's Wednesday, and that means a visit from KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, who wishes he could vote none of the above and get a redo.
Monday night, two Vancouverites in their Jeep sank through the asphalt to where a water main was leaking. Is this a metaphor for American democracy, the veneer of the American system made fragile and dangerous by the long-hidden flood of cash into politics? A large majority of Americans want neither Donnie or Joe to be the next president. More than 10 months away and the slate's already set. Primaries and conventions blaringly revealed for the empty pomp and propaganda they are. But we'll get plenty of distractions here from local politics, with 12 new city councilors, 3 of the 4 current councilors running for mayor instead of trying to keep their jobs. Meanwhile, Oscar nominations were announced yesterday, an extravaganza of multimillionaires in borrowed gowns, suits, and jewelry competing for self-congratulation. Folks in the crowds in movies aren't called extras anymore. They're background, as most of us are, having no part in the action, no lines to speak. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBO Evening News for Wednesday, January 24th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and myself. The producer and engineer tonight is Althea Billings, and I want to take the moment to wish lots of love and our best to engineer extraordinaire volunteer Ray Bodwell. Get well soon. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tagadoff, and Shantia Hudson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. This does not happen without your support. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio and have a great night.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So I don't have to tell anyone listening to this that here in the West, wildfires are a fact of life. I'm also sure that most folks listening are already aware that the climate crisis, combined with more and more homes being built in and around forest lands, is creating an escalating cycle of devastation in fire-prone communities. There is a tremendous amount of pressure on politicians and agencies to act, or at least to be seen to be acting. But right now, too many people, including key decision makers, are looking at the problem entirely backwards. So to talk about the real solutions to protecting communities from wildfires, as well as an exciting piece of legislation making its way through Salem, I am joined by Ralph Bloomers. Ralph is the director of Fire Safe Communities for the Green Oregon Alliance, producer of an award-winning documentary called Elemental, and has worked on forest conservation issues for decades.